So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado from me, Professor Chris Williams will now speak to us about Hwyl and Hiraeth, Richard Burton and Wales.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me just dim the lights at the front here slightly. Okay. I'll start with two quotations from Richard Burton. The first is from an interview with Burton conducted by Kenneth Tynan in Rome in 1966. Tynan asked Burton whether there was anything in the background of Wales, the cultural background, that has specifically influenced your acting. Burton replied, "We had no actors. No actors, you know, for about 40 years. I suddenly realised why we'd never had any actors. It was because all the actors went into the pulpit. The greatest stage in the world. It dominated a village in the chapel. You stood hovering like a great bird of prey over the people in the village. You said, 'I will tell you what is wrong with you and let me examine your soul.' The greatest pulpit in the world. And suddenly, that particular kind of belief went out. They were no longer stars, the great preachers of my childhood. They went out. And the first man in Wales to stop being a preacher and start becoming an actor was Emlyn Williams." Tynan, "Would it be true to say that the thing that drew you to the stage was rhetoric?" Burton, "Oh yes, unquestionably. I think we have a word in Welsh, misused, I believe, by you lot, called hwyl. Nobody can ever translate it. But it's a kind of longing for something, a kind of idiotic, marvellous, ridiculous longing." Second quotation is from a diary entry made by Burton in December 1968. He's in Switzerland, in Gstaad, with Elizabeth Taylor. "I have a record on of 5,000 Welsh voices singing My Dishedi Bobawr, enough to drive you daft with nostalgia. I need you every hour. Oh, yes, boys. This is the 10th time I've played it. The dead stand up in rows before my bloodshot eyes. Sod it all. Sod death, sod age, sod grief, sod loneliness. Gard im taimlo awel o galvaria vren." I've begun with those two quotations because in a rather confusing way they introduce both terms of my title, Hwyl and Hiraeth, and the issue of Richard Burton's relationship with Wales. I'm sure most of you will have realised that in that first quotation, Burton makes an error. Asked by Tynan about rhetoric, he introduces the word hwyl. "Misused, I believe, by you lot," he says, meaning one presumes the English. "No one can ever translate it." Well, it's true, of course, that hwyl defies exact translation, but it certainly doesn't translate, as Burton suggests, as a kind of longing. As we know, it's a rhetoric, it's an oratorical, passionate fervour, initially associated closely with nonconformist preaching, and more latterly with rousing speeches made by Welsh politicians and rugby captains, and occasionally Welsh historians. Now, what Burton means when he refers to longing, of course, is hiraeth, the homesickness, nostalgia, a reverie for one's roots, one's inheritance. And listening to that recording of Welsh male choirs, Burton is possessed by hiraeth, a desire for a return to his family, his friends, his roots in the Avon Valley and Port Talbot. And my argument in this paper is that Richard Burton's relationship with Wales may be characterised by a split between a public hwyl and a private hiraeth. And to explore this, I want to draw extensively, although not exclusively, on Burton's diaries. Now, Burton kept diaries that cover part of 15 years of his life. The first is a pocket diary given to the then Richard Walter Jenkins when he was 14 in November 1939, which he kept to the end of 1940. There's a diary for 1960, incomplete appointments diary. In 1965, the diary years begin, the first of a series of diaries running up to March 1972. The earlier ones are handwritten, the later are typed. The first is in a bound volume, the others are loose-leaved and kept together in folders or binders, binders full of women, or at least one woman, you might say. Well, that sequence constitutes the central core of Burton's writing. After 1972, there are fragments, a diary for part of 1975, another one for about half of 1980, and one for the spring of 1983. put them all together, from November 1939 to April 1983, there's about 390,000 words covering 93 months spread over 44 years. And they contain a very wide range of commentary on various subjects. When I gave the inaugural Richard Burton lecture at Swansea University in 2010, I focused on Burton's interest in and passion for scholarship, his worldview, his reading of biography, history and politics. And Wales was present in that exploration, but it wasn't central to that. But in speaking to this society, I could hardly do anything other than address the question of Burton's relationship with Wales. Now, I'm not the first to look at that. Other scholars, including David Berry, Geoffrey McNab, my colleague Geoffrey Matthews, and Peter Stead, have done that in their own ways. But I suppose what marks my treatment out as distinctive is that it engages explicitly with Burton's writings in his diaries. David Berry, in his monumental Wales and Cinema, comments that assessments of Richard Burton's contribution to cinema in Britain or Wales are problematic. And I think you can extend that by suggesting that assessments of Burton's relationship with Wales and with Welsh culture are also deeply problematic. Berry concentrates, naturally enough, on Burton's Welsh output, things like the films, The Last Days of Dolwyn, Under Milk Wood, the documentaries Borrowed Pasture and Dull and Thomas. If you were going beyond cinema to survey Burton's performative career in The Round, then you might add to this his stage performance, The Druid's Rest, his radio work, including Emlyn Williams's The Corn is Green and Night Must Fall, Saunders Lewis's Brad, and David Jones's In Parenthesis. In addition to the iconic radio production of Under Milk Wood, Burton released a number of LPs of poetry readings. Dylan Thomas featured heavily, but so did R.S. Thomas and poets who are sometimes claimed for Wales, Edward Thomas, Wilfred Owen, and Robert Graves. Burton, of course, provided the narration for that most Welsh of war movies, Zulu. And he gave other narrations to a tourist board documentary, Wales, Heritage of a Nation, and a celebration of the centenary of the Welsh Rugby Union, Touch of Glory. There were television commentaries on Welsh public events, the investiture of the Prince of Wales in 1969, the marriage of the Prince of Wales and Lady Diana Spencer in 1981, and Burton appeared in a fundraising concert following the Aberfan disaster of 1966. Wales occasionally shines through in performances that ostensibly have nothing Welsh about them. So if you listen very carefully, you can catch Richard Burton humming the 18th century Welsh love song Begeulio Gwyneth Gwyn to his ailing wife, played by Maggie McNamara, when he is in the 1955 film Prince of Players, when he's playing the 19th century American actor Edwin Booth. There were many other mooted Welsh projects that did not come off, performing in Gwyn Thomas's The Keep, or as an Iron Bevan in a play also written by Thomas, producing the Dylan Thomas script The Beach at Falesa, or appearing on the television show Ryan and Ronnie with Ryan Davis and Ronnie Williams in 73. These things were discussed, but they didn't happen. Now, for me, the performative career, what was or what might have been, is interesting, but it ought not to be the main focus of Burton's relationship with Wales. I think that to make it such is to suffer from what I might term the dramatic fallacy, to suppose that somehow scenes from Burton's films or plays can be taken as a commentary on his relationship with Wales. And you see this dramatic fallacy very commonly being used by commentators on Burton. So scenes from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf are used as a kind of cinema verite take on the Burton-Taylor marriage, or Burton's performance as the disillusioned spy Alec Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold speaks to Burton's own disenchantment with idealism and his existential despair. Now, I can understand why writers and filmmakers fall into that trap, but I think it is deeply problematic. It's obviously highly selective. Access to Burton's own writings, I think, allow us to escape from the limitations of that approach. Now, I said a moment ago that Burton's relationship with Wales was problematic. And what, you might ask, was the problem? Wasn't Burton the most famous and accomplished Welshman of his generation? The one Welshman with a worldwide reputation, recognised globally for his talents and for how he disposed of them. So much, after all, has passed into legend. One, Burton, we are told, always had a clause in his film contracts giving him the 1st of March off so that he could celebrate St. David's Day. Well, I have to say that in the contracts I've seen in Swansea University, no such clauses exist, but I'm happy to let that one go. Two, Burton reportedly always wore an item of red clothing as a patriotic tribute. When challenged on this matter on the Dick Cavett show, recorded for American television in July 1980, he was able to take off his boots to show Cavett and the audience his red socks. And he claimed to have red underpants on, but we never saw those. Three, Burton is often quoted as having stated that he would have been happier winning a cap for Wales at rugby. And I think with the injury crisis at the moment, if he was alive, he'd stand a chance. happier playing rugby for Wales than playing Hamlet at the Old Vic. And we can turn to the pages of Bledin Williams's memoir, Rugger, My Life, for the authoritative suggestion from Bledin Williams, a distant relative of mine, I'd like to observe, that Richard would have made as good a wing forward as any we have produced in Wales had he not moved into the film industry. Four, Burton was deeply interested in Welsh literature, in Welsh writing in English. In addition to the aforementioned Dylan Thomas, Edward Thomas, Gwynne Thomas and R.S. Thomas and David Jones, Burton was enthusiastic about Alan Lewis, Emir Humphreys, Gerald of Wales, the Mabinogion, David Ap Gwilym and Arthur Machen. And there are many other miscellaneous pieces of evidence which suggest a strong relationship between Burton and Wales. Of course, his first language was Welsh, even if he was a little bit shaky in Rome in 1966. He named his Swiss home in Seligny, Pays de Galles, and of course he was a director of Harlech Television. Victor Spinetti suggested that Richard Burton invented Welshness, and there is some truth in that comment. Spinetti, as a Welsh-Italian from Cwm, could comment with authority and insight, and there are many others who have provided echoing witness. So the Merton Professor of English Literature at Oxford and Burton mentor Neville Coghill referred to Burton's Welsh Glendowerish mystery. Burton biographer Melvin Bragg called Burton a great Welsh hero who never lost his Welshness. The American actor William Redfield, who appeared alongside Burton in Hamlet on Broadway in New York in 1964, wrote that Richard Burton is Welsh and do not ever call him English if you value your somatic well-being. Time magazine pointed out that Burton is Welsh. In fact, he is so thoroughly, defensively and patriotically Welsh that it costs him some loss of perspective. His gallery of great Welshmen includes Louis XIV, Christopher Columbus and Alexander the Great. Now, it was tongue-in-cheek, but Burton was always looking for a good story about Wales to give him a distinctive cachet in Hollywood. Writing in his diary in October 1966, he was tickled to find that there was a report in the Daily American that the Welsh under the King of Gwynedd discovered the USA 200 years before Columbus. Can't wait to show Elizabeth. Some Welsh maniac has spent 20 years proving it, and the results of his researches are to be published in a couple of weeks. I may make it a party piece. Occasional exuberant claims were made. Writing for Look magazine in 1969, Burton reminded its readers that William Shakespeare was taught by a Welshman, Thomas Jenkins, at Stratford Grammar School. Actually, Jenkins was a Londoner. Even less plausibly, that Stratford-upon-Avon is near the Welsh border. It's 70 miles away. And in a joint interview for CBS's 60 Minutes with Elizabeth Taylor in 1970, Burton claimed, albeit with a wicked grin, that Jesus Christ was unquestionably Welsh. So Richard Burton was a quintessential performer of Wales and Welshness, not so much in his acting career, but in his daily life. He acted out his self-appointed role of characteristic Welshman, custodian of the tall tale-telling legacy of Dylan Thomas, controversial interpreter of the meaning of the life and career of Stanley Baker, a gargantuan consumer of alcohol, thus proving his parity with his mining ancestors. All of this reminding America, reminding England, that he and his people were different. Only once did Burton go into print on this topic, and that was in the article for Look magazine, occasioned by the coming together in 1969 of both the investiture and an upsurge in headline-catching Welsh nationalist activity. The article was titled, Who Cares About Whales? I Care. It was written at Burton and Taylor's home in Mexico, and it's a curious mixture of perceptive insights, factual errors, and sentimentality. In it, Burton sticks up resolutely for the rights of the Welsh language. He advocates Welsh medium education in schools. But at the same time, he denounces militant extremism, he dismisses devolution as irrelevant, and he celebrates the English language as perfect for the most breathtaking body of poetry ever presented to civilization. But whatever its contradictions and confusions, Burton is clearly and proudly Welsh. Well, what's to do? I don't know. But I do know that tiny as a nation as we are, and being no better and no worse than other nations, I do know that we are different and that we want to remain so. We don't want to have that hot rush of blood to the head when someone mistakes us for English or think that we are one of England's quainter counties. We want to be uniquely ourselves and we want to keep our unique language. Now, there's no doubt that Burton was sincere in writing this, but what strikes me, given Burton's reputation as a professional Welshman, as someone who stressed his Welsh identity at virtually every public opportunity, what strikes me is that in reading his diaries, I've been surprised to find only relatively sparse commentary on his home country. References of any weight to Wales in the diaries are few and far between, and Burton showed little interest in the state of politics in Wales or in the rise of Welsh nationalism. He mocked the antics of the militants as a shambling, drivel-mouthed, sideways-moving, sly-boots, North Welsh imitation of the Irish. Not that he thought much of the political mainstream. Receiving a letter in 1971 from George Thomas, of course born in Port Talbot, then Labour MP for Cardiff West, former Secretary of State for Wales, he said, "Why do we send such obvious mediocrities to the Commons when there are such brilliant chaps on every street corner at home? I suppose we are all so bloody lazy that we let the dull and insignificant, like Lord Flo Haycock, for Christ's sake, who are prepared to go to party meetings in vestries and half-empty halls to do the job for us." Somewhat improbably, on the 19th of May 1970, Burton speculated as to whether his forthcoming CBE was an attempt by Prime Minister Harold Wilson to placate the Welsh nationalist movement with the general election in mind. So Burton was a patriot, he wasn't a nationalist, but he wasn't a communist either. "Even as a child in the valleys," he wrote in 1968, "I knew there was something not quite right about communism." I think if you try to pigeonhole Burton's politics in relation to Wales, you'd have to say that his was a rather weary socialism. But the clearest expression of Burton's feelings about Wales and its history come not through any semi-philosophical musings on what it meant to be Welsh or where Wales was heading politically, but in negative comments about the English. You'll enjoy this bit. Burton had a profound sense of his rootedness in the mining and heavy industrial communities of South Wales. On more than one occasion, he praised the mining class of the South Welsh. His childhood ambition, he confessed to Dick Cavett, had been to become a miner like his father and older brothers. He sensed an affinity with the Scots. He had no problem with the English of the taciturn Midlands and North Country, but the English establishment aroused his anger most vividly. Reading a biography of Lord Palmerston, who of course was really Irish, in 1971, he noted that the statesman was the kind of English that causes me bright fury and arouses all my usually sleeping hatred of the English. And now, poor bastards, they are worse than ever. Their 2 or 3 centuries of arrogance as a right having turned into pathos. They flared up for a year or two as a result of Churchill and the war, but the post-war debacles killed them stone dead. How I enjoyed Suez and the fools they made of themselves. I watched their every humiliation with great pleasure, though I don't much like reading other people writing about them as I am now. Burton's hatred of the English, I think, was a class hatred, a deep resentment of, a bitterness against those in power, and particularly aimed at the Conservatives, who, it could be argued, had done so much to damage Burton's South Wales in the years of his childhood and adolescence. And this came through very powerfully as Burton awaited the results of the 1970 general election. "My hatred of Tories is unabated by long-term membership of the rich class, and I hope they howl in the wilderness another 5 years. No legislation they might enact could ever make up for their intolerable air of superiority over us lot in the years and years gone by. I hope they grovel forevermore. It's in the context of that sense of a rooted South Wales class background that I think you can understand Richard Burton's notorious 1974 comments about Winston Churchill. Now, these were published in two articles in America in 1974, and they were occasioned by Burton's playing of Churchill, and apologies for the rather poor quality of this image, occasioned by Burton's playing of Churchill in a 90-minute British-American co-production for television titled Walk with Destiny in the US and The Gathering Storm in the UK. Now, Burton had been reading Churchill's own words and biographies of Churchill and of the Churchill family for years. He'd met Churchill in the 1950s. In 1960 and 61, he'd read from Churchill's memoirs in a documentary series for ABC, later broadcast on the BBC. And there is a story that Burton told that Churchill had recommended him for that part. He owned a Jacob Epstein bust of Churchill. He'd been asked by the Churchill family to play this part on screen, and for some reason, which is not entirely clear, he'd given a colour television set to Clementine Churchill just weeks before publishing these articles. The screen portrayal in Walk with Destiny was a triumph, but Burton found himself at the centre of his own gathering storm as his articles met with outrage and anger on both sides of the Atlantic. In preparing himself to play one of the scatological, dispossessed youngest sons of the aristocracy, as he termed Churchill, Burton was very keen to make it clear that he disassociated himself from Churchill as a historical figure, whose essence he was thought to have captured so well on screen. He characterised Churchill as short, obese, vigorous, pugnacious, something of a vulgarian, power-mad, and for a time at least almost insane with power, afraid of nothing either physically or morally. Burton disparaged Churchill's barren intellect, his superficial education, his slow and ponderous wit. He questioned his sanity. He quoted Aniron Bevan's description of him as a petrified adolescent. And he accused him of genocide in respect of the bombing of Dresden. He even ranked Churchill alongside Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, Lenin, Hitler and Stalin. Now, Burton was aiming to shock, to stun, I think, his audience with his phrases, and yet at the same time, he did concede some grudging respect for Churchill. He expressed some puzzlement in his own mind as to what to make of him. He admired Churchill's capacity to drink. He wrote that his last service to the free world he served so well might well have been to leave us his liver to wonder at. He considered him one of the greatest orators of his time, a great natural force, and he praised his steadfastness in resisting Hitler in 1940. And he admitted that when he'd met Churchill in person, he'd been awed, frightened, almost to silence, he wrote. The shock of his presence was like a blow under the heart. I cannot pretend otherwise, though my class and his hate each other to seething point. In a later interview, Burton was to reflect further on this class hatred. Churchill, he claimed, had been the great oppressor of the South Wales miners during the Cambrian Combine Strike of 1910-1911, and he blamed him for the deaths of 19 miners or thereabout at that time. The actual death toll was one or seven if we add in the deaths associated with the Finchley Railway Strike of 1911. Burton won rather more accolades when writing about Welsh rugby than about Welsh industrial history. In 1970, he contributed an article with a Welsh title, Llema Bloody Film Star Yma, to Touchdown, the anthology celebrating the centenary of the Rugby Football Union. He followed that up a couple of years later with a contribution to the Barry John Book of Rugby. But the most profound engagement with Wales comes not in Richard Burton's adult diaries or in his occasional articles on Welsh subjects, but rather in the diary that he kept as Richard Walter Jenkins, living in Caradoc Street in Tyburn. Now, this was the pocket diary given him as a present when he was 14 in November 1939. He keeps it for the whole of 1940, and I think the diaries constitute a remarkably unself-conscious commentary on the cultural and social world of the future Richard Burton. well before he could have had any inkling of what awaited him in life. It's a fascinating document from a number of viewpoints. It sheds light on the complicated, troubled domestic relationship in which Richard found himself, particularly the tensions with his brother-in-law Elved, in whose home he'd been living since the age of two. It offers up, in passing, a schoolboy's experience of wartime, German bombing raids on Swansea and Port Talbot, aerial combat involving Spitfires, the blackout, barrage balloons, air raid shelters, older brothers being called up, the Battle of Narvik, the fall of France, the miracle of Dunkirk, and how all of that fitted into the daily routine. So on the 10th of May, Richard noted, "Holland, Luxembourg and Belgium invaded by Adolf and his crazy gang. They are being held. I think this is Germany's great and first mistake. Played tennis with die. He won." The diary is a reminder of the harshness of working class life. The very first entry records the premature death of Richard's sister-in-law Cassie, the woman who had raised his brother Graham after their mother's death. Another character who regularly appears is Elved James's brother-in-law Ben, who'd been confined to a wheelchair following an underground accident and who was a crack player of a new game newly arrived from America, Monopoly. From the point of view of understanding Richard's Welsh world, the diary is full of raw material. Richard was attending Noddfa Welsh Congregational Chapel on Commercial Road in Tybach almost every Sunday, often for more than one service, and for Sunday school and chapel Eisteddfodau as well. In December 1940, shortly before the diary ends, he was received into chapel membership and he could take communion for the first time. He comments on whether the sermons of the veteran and charismatic minister, Dr. J. Kyra Rees, were successful or not. He looked forward to the arrival of visiting preachers, sometimes getting their autographs. His sister stopped him from going to chapel on one Sunday because until he got his new suit, anticipated the following week, he was not considered respectable enough in his old togs. He went to cinema almost as often to chapel. I've counted 42 visits in the diary, usually to the Picturedrome, or Cach, which was the local flea pit, sometimes to the more expensive Regent in Tybach, or to the Palace, Plaza, or the Majestic, Wales's latest luxury cinema, in the centre of Port Talbot. And he was an eclectic sampler of cinematic treats. Shipyard Sally with Gracie Fields, Q-Planes with Laurence Olivier and Ralph Richardson, The Oklahoma Kid with James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart, The Flying Deuces with Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. Sometimes these visits, as with the one on the 12th of September, were surreptitious. "I went to the Cach and did not tell Sis, but the following day he was in trouble. This morning the milk boy told Sis that he had seen me in the Cach eating chocolates, etc. But I denied it, and she believed me, at least I think so, although it was no crime." The other great leisure activity recorded in the pages of the diary is sports and pastimes. Richard was intensely competitive. The playing of Monopoly occupied many evenings. Eventually he beat Ben James. Then there were darts, billiards, putting in the park, swimming in the town baths on Forge Road, playing postball, a bit like basketball, tennis, cricket, association football, a variety of track and field athletics, and especially, always, rugby union. And here is Richard. The point about the potential that he had to play rugby to a high standard is substantiated by those in whose company he is to be found. These include future Wales internationals, such as Alan Thomas and Gerwyn Williams, others such as Brindley Phillips, Trevor George and Stan Walters, who enjoyed successful first-class club careers, and others still, such as Freddie Williams, the two-time World Speedway champion in the 1950s, who achieved in different sports. That competitive streak was carried over into two other areas of his life. You get the sense from the diary that Richard began, around this time, to take his schooling very seriously, that he sensed that academic achievement might, for him, be possible and could lead somewhere. On the 29th of April, he wrote, "I am determined to work hard in school this term, 25th of July. Had my report this morning, it was very good compared with last term's report. I realised an average of 56.5. There's nothing in the diary at all to reinforce his later claim that he wanted only to be a minor. Day after day, he recorded his progress in homework, in exams, the slow elevation of his grade averages, his struggles with Welsh and physics, his more rapid advances in English, history, mathematics and chemistry. On the 15th of September, determined to work hard at school and break all records by passing matric first time. Very few Form 5M boys have ever done it. 18th of November, played football in the gym. Only five of us there. Did a lot of swatting tonight. I should get a fairly good result at terminals, especially in chem. I am still worried about Welsh. I'm afraid jog is not going to be a great help. He was already an avid reader. I am reading on average about three books in 2 days. The books came from school, were loaned from friends and family, were borrowed from the Carnegie Library on Commercial Road in Taibach. And Richard's competitive streak was also identifiable in what you might call grafting, hobbling, a search for casual income. This was achieved through gathering dung for sale as manure for gardens and allotments, collecting newspapers for wrapping fish and chips, picking back blackberries to make jam, doing odd jobs or running errands for family members and neighbours, helping out on an occasional basis at the Taibach and Port Talbot Co-op, where he would later briefly be employed, tramping the streets, singing Christmas carols. On the 2nd of August, he wrote, "Went up the colliery to fetch Elved's pay. He gave me sixpence, and Verdon, his brother, gave me a shilling. As soon as I came home, I had a haircut in Sandy's. Later on, I had sixpence off Dad James. Went to Cach to see Arsenal Stadium mystery." He recorded how much money he earned, how much he spent on his clothes. He built up a collection of 40 ties. It's a reminder of how important and immediate subsistence was. So what emerges very strongly from this schoolboy diary is Richard's intense competitiveness, his brash self-confidence, his rootedness within a full sense of community, and his ambition. This entry, 1st of June 1940, combines so much, I think, of that spirit of this 14-year-old boy. "Did all my errands as usual and changed my library book in the afternoon. Went to the Regent Cinema. I saw a picture called The Four Feathers. Showed what family tradition can do to a man. This man was sent four white feathers, but he proved them wrong." Richard's world was geographically delimited. Swansea, Neath, Pontrydyfen, Llantwit Major, Aberdare, Bridgend, Tonerefi. Institutionally, it was also circumscribed. The chapel, the school, the co-op, the YMCA on Station Road. But it was a full world. It was a whole world. It was replete with potential and rewards, and there's a vibrancy about it. We know from sources other than Richard's diary that important people came to speak in the library and the chapels at this time. The poet Hugh Menai, the veteran socialist Minnie Pallister, the Labour Party intellectual Harold Laskey, the minor writer B.L. Coombs, the miners leader and Member of Parliament James Griffiths. And there was a sense in which Port Talbot, and this was the world, felt itself fully relevant, central to what was happening. In 1943, the Port Talbot Guardian suggested that it should be made the capital of Wales. "The Cardiff-Swansea controversy is, I think, tedious. As far as the predominant south is concerned, Port Talbot, with half the population of Wales within a 30 miles radius, has as good a title as anywhere." Richard's world was packed full of family members, friends, school pupils, teachers, authority figures. Those Richard admired most appeared to be a few of the teachers, including Philip Burton, and those who had sporting credentials. Drama, theatre, was present. Richard records preparing for his part as Mr. Van Hatten in a school production of George Bernard Shaw's The Apple Cart. This is a later production, of course, but it was not yet a major theme in his life. The realisation that his talent would take Richard in that direction had still to arrive. Well, that took place over the next 3 years. Richard Jenkins became Richard Burton and left Wales in the autumn of 1943 to appear in his first professional stage production, The Druid's Rest. He went on to spend time at Oxford University, in the RAF, in various bases around England and in Canada, and on demobilisation from the forces, went straight into a career on stage and screen. He never lived in Wales again. He based himself initially in London and from 1957 in Switzerland. He never seriously considered returning to Wales. Even when he thought about coming back to the UK, it was to England, to London, or to Oxford that appealed most. He did, of course, go back occasionally to Pontrhyd y Fen and Tai Bach, usually with a great fanfare as the unofficial Prince of Wales, but never for more than a few days. And after almost 3 decades of living in Europe, Mexico, on a yacht in the Mediterranean, spending a lot of time in the US, he died in Switzerland and was buried in Seligny in August 1984. The funeral service included the Welsh air Sospan Fach. He was buried in red with a copy of Dylan Thomas's poems. But his decision to lay his bones on Swiss soil was an emotional one. He reasoned that he'd been happiest in Pays de Galles, his home from home. The adult Richard Burton performed his Welshness with Hoyle. But the Welshness that Richard Burton preserved, displayed and consumed as a globe-trotting international film star and celebrity could hardly be anything other than reified. It became reduced to a series of labels, badges, boxes to be ticked, coal mining and class politics, alcohol, Welsh male voice, rugby, a sometimes shaky grasp of the Welsh language and Welsh history, a reverence for the greats of Welsh literature. But it was frozen, it was static, it was stagnant, it was ossified. And I think that outcome was unavoidable, given Burton's lifestyle and lack of any continuing real connection to the Wales that was evolving in his absence. The angst of the realisation that his living connections to Wales had been permanently severed comes through powerfully in this, my last quotation from the diaries in July 1969. And it's written after a short-lived attempt to stay off alcohol had come to an abrupt end the previous day. Being relatively sober for the last 3 or 4 days, I've learned a great deal. Drink, for instance, is a great anodyne. I'd forgotten how boring people are. I'd forgotten how afraid people are. I'd forgotten how boring I am, and how all of us lead lives of quiet desperation and bugger you, Thoreau. It is some ungodly hour in the morning. I have, since the above paragraph, taken a shower, cleaned myself of every orifice, laboured over the cleansing of a body which will never be clean, examined a brain, some cells of which will never function properly again, and in general have dismissed me as a completely lost cause. There is no going back. There is no Isaiah's burning coal to cauterise a lifetime of self-indulgence. What would you like to do, Rich? You want a back room in Paddington with a gas fire and bobs to put in it and no bath but a public one around the corner just off Praed Street? You want a good girl who thinks you are the world's best bank clerk and will defend you against any bank manager who cares to take you on at the staff party? Well, you won't find one, baby. You want Pontrhyd y Fen and the unbelievably bad weather and 10 quid a week and the lust for the pint that you can't afford and the other man has? You can't have it, fella. I mean, you can have the pint, but not the lust. Go home, said George Moore to John Millerton Synge. Go home. Well, I got news for you, Thomas Wolfe. You can't go home no more. At Richard Burton's core remained a profound hiraeth, not for the Wales as was, but for the Wales which, at the age of 18, he had left forever. That Wales had been, in the term employed by Professor Alfred Zimmern, an American South Wales in its final flourish, bouncing back with confidence and brio from the hardships of the Depression years as the Second World War began to crank up. That was the Wales in which Burton's politics had been forged. That was the Wales which had equipped him with so many of the intellectual and emotional resources that would serve him so well in his career. John Gielgud is reported as saying that Richard Burton came from nowhere. A remark that, if it is true, illustrates a failure of understanding on the part of Sir John. We know that Richard Burton didn't come from nowhere. He came from somewhere. He came from a South Wales that first he and now we have lost. And the rich texture of that South Wales is evident in the first diary that Richard Walter Jenkins kept. Thank you very much.